my message has always been, don't believe me. What? Who cares who I am? Look at the information itself. Is it real? Is it verifiable? Is it accurate? Is it accurately presented in an accurate context that helps you to better understand the world? If so, great, take that information on board. But there's no reason to be looking at any individual as this person is a source of truth, this person is not.
Welcome back to the Collapse Life Podcast. I'm your host, Zara Sefanan. I'm so pleased to have you with us. On this podcast, we often talk about the loss of trust in institutions. And one place that is very evident is trust in the legacy media. It's at all-time lows, and it doesn't seem like there's much hope of turning that around. But alternative media has been around to fill that void for a long time. But even that's getting harder and harder. Here to talk to us about that today is James Corbett, founder of The Corbett Report. James has been an independent and an alternative voice since 2007, so he's seen a lot of changes in this regard. So James, I want to thank you so much for joining us. And before we get started, I also want to thank David Gardner of the Freedom Convo podcast for connecting us.
Thank you for having me here.
I'm so happy to have you. I've seen so many of your videos, so it's very nice to see you in person. And I know that we don't have too much of your time, so I don't want to start with a whole backstory, but I would encourage anyone who's not familiar with your background to look at your website, The Corbett Report, and look for the Who is James Corbett posts, because you do a very good job of talking about your background there. But maybe we can then just dive right into our conversation. So I would just start by saying, I think that alternative media has become a more important feature of people's lives for an even larger group of people in recent years, especially in this COVID era. But we've also seen increasing regulations and deplatforming and censorship. So start us off big picture. What do you think is sort of the immediate future for independent journalism, like over the next 6 to 12 months?
Before I get into the immediate future, I think it's incredibly important to look at the recent past, because I think so few people, even among my own audience and even sometimes myself, fail to appreciate the nature, the absolute seismic cataclysmic, catastrophic, whatever way you want to frame it, change that has just taken place structurally in our society over the past few decades with the advent of the World Wide Web and the proliferation of these devices that make it truly possible for a nobody, an English teacher in Japan, to suddenly start a podcast that ultimately accrues millions upon millions upon millions of listeners around the world. That is a revolution. The beginning of which we are seeing right now, that we can only really start to understand. We can't even really start to understand the incredible nature of the revolution that we're living through. So it's important to keep that in perspective, because I think when the real history of the 21st century is written, most of the political events and things that are passing through the newswires will be long forgotten. The thing that will be remembered is the incredible change in the structure of our society that has taken place through this transformation of our communications technology. Having said that, yes, as you are quite rightly gesturing to, exactly as with, I always put it in the framework of the original mass media revolution of the Gutenberg press and the way that fundamentally changed society completely, changed the course of human history, really. It didn't take long for centers of power to realize that they were very much put in jeopardy by the free flow of information. Suddenly, they didn't have a stranglehold on the flow of information. So you saw the kings and queens of the time trying to crack down on the press in any way they could, and having license fees for printing press and things like this, in order to try to regulate and restrict and control the information flow. Well, I think we are starting to see the beginnings of that in the 21st century equivalent of the Gutenberg Revolution, with the attempts to curtail the free flow of information under the name of misinformation, disinformation, what have you. So in the near term, we are going to see a lot more of the same, I would say. We are starting to see the narratives that have been developed to make at least a sizable proportion of the public open to the idea of censorship under the guise of, well, we have to protect ourselves from misinformation, disinformation, malinformation, which of course is the latest weaponized word, which means, well, it's true, but we don't like it, so you can't say it. And unfortunately, a lot of the public is being indoctrinated into this right now, and I'm starting to hear it from regular people that, yes, we do need censorship. It's good. Free speech is a bad thing, which,
right.
I mean, put yourself back a few decades ago, it would have been pretty remarkable for your average American to be talking about the wonders and the good parts of government censorship. But here we are. So unfortunately, we are going to be going through this gauntlet. We're already starting to, but it's going to get worse from here. I don't see a way out of that, at least not in the short term.
I think what's so remarkable about this absolute revolution that we're going through, as you mentioned, is that it's different from the Gutenberg Press in the sense that we now have the ability to create things that are not real and present them as though they are real. And the way that we're consuming this information is literally changing our brain, our brain physiology. And there's chemical and physical changes that happen in our brain. I don't know whether that happened with the advent of the printing press, but we're at a kind of next level of this. So social media is not going away anytime soon. As you say, it's likely that the censorship and all of that is going to get worse, and they're going to just call it what it is. It is censorship, but it's for your own good. So how do we help people in your audience and my audience to stay kind of on the narrow path and be able to distinguish truth from falsity?
It's an important question, and increasingly important as you say, the technology becomes more and more advanced to make the unreal appear real. I will just parenthetically say that I think that did exist in the Gutenberg revolution as well, with regards to the very fact that the early novels and things that were really, in a sense, you could say the novel was a result of the printing press, because most of what was copied by hand by scribes from time immemorial were the types of classic works by the classic authors, etc. The idea of just Joe Schmo writing a novel and publishing it would have been insane, in the idea that there would be scribes copying out hundreds of copies of this. I mean, no, the novel was invented by that. And early novels were always presented as factual first-person accounts of this or that. I mean, Don Quixote and Gulliver's Travels and Robinson Crusoe and everything else were presented as this was a true story that really happened. And one could imagine all of the hand-wringing that must have gone on about the, imaginative sea creatures and things that were being written about in the books. Well, anyway, here we are today in the 21st century, where the equivalent of that is increasingly the deep fakes and the generated images and just straight up lies that can be presented as facts, etc., etc. So yes, some media literacy is definitely needed to find your way through this morass. But I would say that in a sense, this is sort of the eternal question. People can lie to you. How do you know when they're lying to you? And there is no perfect answer to that. You can be duped and presumably will be duped at some point, but you can arm yourself against that with certain basic standard techniques that humans have used throughout history. Like, for example, triangulation of data, rather than simply relying on one person said this one thing, therefore it's true. Well, can you verify it from a few different angles? And how can you verify that? And can you set up systems that might be amenable to, for example, crowdsourcing information and truth so that you can verify it from numerous different peoples in a trusted community, et cetera, et cetera. These are the types of things that I'm not so worried about, because if humans are left to their own devices, I think they will come up with the organic solutions to these types of problems. It's when there is outside state control trying to tell you, no, this is the arbiter of truth, and everyone must use this. That's when we run into the danger of the centralization of information.
Yeah. Would, as someone who creates media, what do you do to kind of show your sources or to help your viewers get halfway in terms of triangulating that information or verifying it? What role do you think content creators have to play in that?
So the tagline of the Corbett Report from its very inception was open source intelligence news. And that was a very deliberate choice on my part, because one of the founding ethos of my website was the idea that I was going to cite my sources. And that shouldn't That should not be, I think, an unusual thing. But I do recall at that time, certainly if you went to any mainstream media article that was online in the early 2000s, New York Times or Washington Post or anything else, there would never, ever, ever be a hyperlink to anything, any sort of outside document whatsoever. It was just like a newspaper, but online. So they would just tell you there was this government report and this person said that and this thing happened. But they would never link to any source for any of that because it's the New York Times. I mean, of course, they've got editors and fact checkers and all that. So don't worry about it. Don't worry your pretty little heads about it. We'll tell you what happened. Thankfully, that has changed over the course of the past couple of decades as people realized, oh my God, it's the internet. If I'm writing about a government report, I can link you directly to that report. And I would like to see not only that that becomes standard, but when people don't link you to an actual report itself, you should be thinking, why? Why aren't they giving me that link? Why are they trying to make me work for it? And what are they trying to hide? And in fact, this literally just came up recently for me when I was reading about this BRICS declaration and everyone was talking about BRICS declaration, but nobody linked to the BRICS declaration. What are they trying to hide? Why don't they want me to read this document for myself? So I dug it up. And when I put it on my New World Next Week show that I do every week with James Evan Pilato at Media Monarchy, we cover news stories every week. I link to the document so that people can go and read it for themselves. And I want that to not only be unusual, but to be the standard to the point where people question why people aren't providing sources when they don't.
I think that's a great point. We, by the way, did also link to it from Collapse Life, but I think that's a really interesting way of looking at it, that if you don't provide a source document, then there must be something suspect. So that's a kind of a behavior shift. I think a lot of the kind of people that would follow you or if you want to call them red-pilled, we are now at the point where we're so cynical that if someone like you has been able to survive the maelstrom since 2007, people might ask why. Like, what is it about him that they allow him to keep doing what he's doing? I know that there have been all the accusations of conspiracy theory and misinformationist thrown out there, but somehow you still managed to kind of ride the top of the wave. So what are your thoughts on that? How do you skirt that issue? And what do you think about that sort of cynicism?
I guess I could put the pin on my lapel here by saying, well, actually, I mean, I was scrubbed off of YouTube, which seems like a pretty large move in this day and age, considering I am sure that 90% of my audience up to that point had probably found me through YouTube. So getting taken off of YouTube was a pretty big thing for me. But of course, I don't want to fall into the trap of saying that because I was taken off of YouTube, therefore you can trust me, because that, of course, that doesn't logically follow. And that means that it would be extremely easy for people who are trying to, for example, burnish the credentials of a truth teller who is, in fact, some sort of controlled opposition. Well, let's scrub him off of YouTube and everyone will find him on all of these alternate platforms. And then they'll go, hey, he was scrubbed off of YouTube, therefore he's telling the truth. It doesn't work that way. It's not that simple. And just because someone is on YouTube doesn't mean that they're lying. This is the sort of, again, it's like the triangulating information when people are lying, misinformation, deep fakes. How will we ever possibly know? Can you verify from different angles? And if you can verify someone's information, then take that information for what it's worth. But my message has always been, don't believe me. Who cares who I am? Look at the information itself. Is it real? Is it verifiable? Is it accurate? Is it accurately presented in an accurate context that helps you to better understand the world? If so, great. Take that information on board. But there's no reason to be looking at any individual as this person is a source of truth, this person is not. Which is why I devote exactly 0.0% of my time to lecturing my audience, listen to this person, don't listen to this person, this source is to be trusted, this source is not to be trusted, because that's a fool's game. And I think that misses the point. The point is the information itself and what you can make of that information. Because I suppose people could present true and accurate information about the world that is completely irrelevant to you and changes nothing about your life. Would you want to continue listening to that source? I personally wouldn't. One of the metrics that I use when I'm listening to a podcast or watching a video, a few minutes in, I will go, have I learned anything so far? And if the answer is no, do I need to continue listening or watching? Probably not. I got better things to do with my time. So I just want to learn information. And I don't, personally, I don't really get the mindset of people who are looking for people to follow rather than information to learn.
Maybe it's a vestige of, you know, the time when we had three stations and, you know, you either watched A, B, or C, or ABC, or you watched the CBC, or, you know, and so we're used to having that, that one voice that you listen to every night, and they told you the top stories, and then you could go to bed and watch the Wheel of Fortune and you're okay. I mean, it is funny. You're right. It's just, it does seem a human instinct from the time when we would sit around the campfire and one person would be the storyteller and we just all listen. But it's, I think that's a very good point that, you know, it really is incumbent on all of us to do the work. We can't just be passive. We have to be very active in consuming and creating the content. Just really quickly, so one of the tools that people have had in the toolbox in terms of verifying content online was the Wayback Machine. It was a way to be able to put in a URL and see what it looked like 6 months ago, a year ago. And you could use it to actually show when changes had been made, when there were sort of stealth edits made to a page that people didn't want you to know about. It was a very useful tool for very many things. But for the past sort of month or so, that tool has gone offline. And there are rumors that this was perhaps deliberate, right? Especially because it's happening right before the election. And it's maybe a way for, you know, history to be rewritten. How dangerous do you think those kinds of vulnerabilities are?
It's exceptionally dangerous. And yes, again, this speaks to the danger of centralization of knowledge itself. The Internet Archive, which is what runs the Wayback Machine and also has many, many other useful resources, a library of Alexandria for the Internet age, in a sense, is incredibly, incredibly useful. But its utility actually speaks to how utterly, incredibly insane it is that it is essentially the only thing online that is doing that, for example, the Wayback Machine. In fact, even Google Cache, which existed up until recently, where you could find a cached version of various search results, that has been discontinued. So even that has gone away. It is getting incredibly difficult to find memory hold information of various sorts, and more difficult all the time. That is truly a fundamentally, existentially, perhaps, large threat to information online. And anyone who doesn't understand that, for example, just go back to one of my early podcasts from 2007, 2008, 2009. As I say, I always cite my sources, so there will be plenty of links to sources. Maybe 10% of those links will actually be working anymore. Because it's the internet, you know, a 15-year-old link probably isn't going to work so well. So what do you do in that case? Well, luckily, there's the Wayback Machine, and I've used that extensively throughout my research and throughout my time online. And the idea of that going away is truly horrifying. One would like to think that this would at least be a wake-up call for other groups to start mirroring and or copying the work, essentially, of the Wayback Machine and doing something like that themselves. I know there are other tools that exist, for example, archive.today, but that's a slightly different thing, and it doesn't automatically cache every single page on basically every website on the internet. So, again, it's one of those things. It's mind-bogglingly large, so one understands why not everyone is able to do that. But it is incredibly useful. So the idea that Library of Alexandria may be on fire, may be about to disappear forever, is incredibly, scary, really, because we are living in the age of Orwell's 1984. I hate to constantly bring it back to that, but we are at the point where the memory hole is a real thing and they can really change reality. And if you don't have something like that, some arbiter that's looking there saying, no, this is what they said on this webpage 5 years ago, and this is what they're saying today, something changed. If we don't have that, we will never be able to tell what is real and what is fake, because there's no way to triangulate that information.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an incredibly important tool, but you make a really good point that, you know, it should not be in the hands of one organization to do that task, which leads me to, you know, the idea that we need to decentralize our information architecture, basically, and have parallel systems, if you want to call them that, or other alternative platforms. And so let's talk a little bit about what that might look like and, you know, what exists now. How robust is it? And what do we need? What are we missing in terms of a more decentralized model?
Let me tell you the great news, the wonderful news, the amazing news that for some reason no one cares about and no one wants to hear, and it will change absolutely nothing with regard to anyone's daily internet activity, although it should. The tool for actually and truly decentralizing so that we don't have to worry about third-party censorship middlemen stepping in to stop people, to scrub you from YouTube, and suddenly you lose the 600,000 subscribers I had at the time in which they deleted my channel, etc. You don't have to worry about it because the technology for circumventing all of that exists, and it has existed for at least, 2.5 decades now? It's called Really Simple Syndication, RSS. And it existed long before there was any sort of social media, before MySpace was a twinkle in Jack's eye, whatever. That guy that everyone was friends with back on MySpace, whatever. You know what I'm talking about. Really Simple Syndication is an incredibly simple, incredibly powerful concept. And it is what's essentially launched podcasting itself. The idea of podcasting became possible with this. So instead of having some centralized third-party middleman like Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, whatever, as being the middleman institution, which will allow you to sign up and create an account, and then people will follow you on that platform, which they can scrub you off of at any time, or they can throttle you and they can algorithmically throttle your search results, et cetera, et cetera. Instead of that, what we had back in the early stages of the World Wide Web revolution was peer-to-peer connection, where I have an RSS feed that I host on my server or some place where you can access it. And it will essentially, every time I put up a new podcast episode or whatever it is, a new post on my website, it will update the RSS feed. You will get that automatically through your RSS feed reader, which is constantly reading, is there an update? Is there an update? Oh, there's an update. And then it will allow you, here's the link, so you can go and get my file directly from me. There's no middleman. There's no third-party institution in between us. If you follow me, you're following me. And every time I update, you will instantly, automatically get it in your feed reader. That is a wonderful, amazing, incredible, powerful technology, which was deliberately destroyed by the big internet giants that, of course, have their bread buttered on the side of, no, you don't want that peer-to-peer connection. What you want is to sign up for an account with us and do all of your communication with your followers through us. And we'll decide if people can follow you, if people can see your work, when and how people can see your work, whether or not we want you on our platform at all. And we can just go like this, and all of those hundreds of thousands of people who said, yes, I want to see this guy's work, will never see you again. Yay. It's insane. But when you look at the history of RSS and how it was destroyed, it's just so obvious no one ever talks about it. It's very strange. But for example, there was an incredibly useful tool called FeedBurner, which allowed people to easily create an RSS feed and easily host it, and so that people would be able to follow them. It was a very useful tool that was fairly widely used in the 2000s era, and then was taken over by Google, which immediately stopped updating it, stopped working on it, stopped promoting it, and after maybe 2 or 3 years, completely discontinued it. It now no longer exists. Yay! Wonderful! Thank you. Why would Google buy this incredibly useful tool and then completely abandon it and delete it and scrub it from internet history so that no one even knows what RSS anymore is anymore. It's precisely because they want to be that third-party institution. They don't want you to know there is a technology that allows you to circumvent that, which is why I always tell people, if you're interested in my work, figure out how to use an RSS feed reader and subscribe to my RSS, and then you never have to worry about whether I'm being censored from this or that internet platform. So anyway, there's the good news. Everyone who's listening can now instantly find their favorite creators and to subscribe to them directly without ever having to worry about censorship. But 99% of them won't. And oh, by the way, 99% of creators these days don't even know about RSS and don't bother to have an RSS feed. It's insane to me. Absolutely.
It is pretty eye-opening because I remember having them built into my browser and going to that little tab and seeing all the new stuff. Don't RSS readers, though, still have to be created by some sort of third party between you and your reader?
RSS readers are a separate thing, but they can be open source RSS readers. I mean, there are a million different types of RSS readers. You could code your own if you are code inclined. You could do your own. So again, it's you don't have to reinvent the wheel and you don't have to have an elaborate system in place for it. And you could certainly there could be dodgy RSS reader companies that are trying to scarf up your data or what have you. But again, you have the choice. There's a million different choices and you're not locked into anything like you are when you sign up for a Twitter account or YouTube or what have you.
That's amazing. So instead of giving someone your email address or your Twitter handle or whatever, you just start handing them your RSS address and they can connect with you there.
That's it.
That's a great idea. I love it. Which brings me to kind of, you know, a return to the past in a way. Do you think that, I think I was listening to something with you describing your early days and you were actually kind of saving things to CDs and DVDs and sharing them with people before you started your own podcast. Do you think we'll see a return to a more kind of physical peer-to-peer way of communicating? I mean, you and I wouldn't be able to have this conversation if that were the case.
No, it's true. And maybe the question really is how far do they take the censorship and how whether or not the ever evolving arms race between those who want to centralize information and those who want to keep it decentralized, who is ahead in that race and how bad does it get? But I sincerely hope that physical media and physical ways of exchanging information never disappear entirely. They should always be kept alive. Whether it would become the main way in which political dissidents and people who are saying things that are not allowed to say communicate, that would unfortunately be probably a sign that we're losing in this incredibly digital age. As the rest of society goes on their merry digital way. But it is a possibility. But I think it does speak to the fact that the independent media, I don't think, will ever fully disappear. Because as bad as things might get, I have to remind myself that, oh yeah, but when I was growing up, a few decades ago, when there was essentially no World Wide Web and no internet, people were still communicating and still, I mean, it was just in the form of the weekly underground political zine that would get, passed around on college campuses or what have you. There was always people who had that will and gumption to get that information out there in incredibly laborious and time-consuming and probably very unprofitable ways, but people still did it. And in a sense, actually, maybe, I don't like to think of it this way, but maybe that's a good filter. When it is as easy as it is in our day and age to sign up for a YouTube account or an Instagram account or what have you, and just a TikTok or whatever the kids are using, who knows, and start instantly just putting out all of your thoughts with very little in the way of barriers, it does kind of dilute the information and the value of that information. But somebody who is going to incredibly great lengths of time and expense and resources in order to put out an underground zine or something like that, that will probably be read by 100 people, you know, they really care about what they're doing and they're really putting thought into it. So in a sense, maybe the people who persist to that level are the ones who really want to get that information out there.
How do you solve for that profitability question, though, for something like that? So, you know, your RSS feed idea, brilliant. But then, you know, I mean, this is probably a reality for you. This is what you do. So how do you keep the lights on? How do you get people to support you if they can't buy a subscription to you or you can't get monetized on YouTube or things like that?
It's a good question. Yeah. Yeah. Well, essentially, so from the very beginning, again, just like with what were we were just discussing. Anyway, whatever we were discussing before. But oh yeah, open source intelligence. From the very beginning, it was important that I cite my sources. And from the very beginning, it was always important that my work is free, freely available, that I'm not going to put something behind the paywall and you have to subscribe in order to see this thing. I do have a subscriber newsletter, but the editorial that is the meat and potatoes of that is I put up for free on my Substack. So I always wanted the information to be free and open. And when I started the website, I remember getting a lot of people saying, yeah, but what? You make a documentary and you put it up for free online? How are you going to, you should sell it as a DVD. Like, how are you going to make money? Right. And I didn't know, but I had faith that if people like my work and want to support it, they will support it. So that was the philosophy I used. And I'm still here. It's 17 years later. So it has worked for me. Having said that, I understand that people coming up today in the James Corbett of 2024 would be very different than the James Corbett of 2007, because it was a very different media environment at that time. So who knows how people can make that work today. But I still think that ultimately, if you're providing quality information, people will want that. And again, I think if it is motivated by the monetary principle, it's not going to work. If people are doing it because they want to make a living out of it, because they want money out of it, it can work for some time and it might be good, but it will not be the same. I know I don't expect anyone to believe this, but I know it to be true. I did not get into this because of money and, oh, I'm gonna get famous and rich on the internet. Absolutely not. In fact, for the first 3 or 4 years of the website, I didn't even have a subscription. I didn't have any way for people could support me like that, because that wasn't what it was about. And I, again, it's like the filter of the people who are putting out the newsletter or the underground zine, despite the fact that they're not going to make any fame or fortune at it, because they truly care about it. The people who are doing it, not because they're thinking about the monetization of it, are the ones that truly care about getting information out there. And you're probably going to get, at the very least, you're going to get people who actually are putting time, effort, and care into what they're doing rather than people who are doing it just to make a quick buck.
Yeah, absolutely. For those who aren't familiar with the Corbett Report, can you just talk a little bit about the types of media that you produce there and the types of topics that you cover?
So when I started in 2007, it was originally going to be simply a podcast, a weekly podcast where I was going to talk for about half an hour on any given subject. That very, very, very quickly became, well, I have to do interviews, I should write articles, and oh, it's the current era, so I should do videos as well. So eventually it became all sorts of media production. So it's a mishmash of all sorts of audio and visual media. And I talk about whatever I want to talk about. And luckily, I have a fairly diverse range of interests when it comes to politics and society and news and information and science and history and philosophy and what have you. So I never run out of things to talk about. But it has been a labor of love for 17 years now. And I like to think that the work speaks for itself.
What do you think the most impactful work that you've done has been? Have there been any pieces that you've done that have actually made changes?
I know the ones that resonate most with my audience. Well, the number one that went viral at the time and still gets talked about to this day, and if people have encountered my work, it's probably this video, was a short little 5-minute parody video I did. On the morning of September 11th, 2001, 19 men armed with box cutters directed by a man on dialysis in a cave fortress halfway around the world using a satellite phone and a laptop directed the most sophisticated penetration of the most heavily defended airspace in the world. About 9/11 truth. It was regarding those subjects. It was kind of the official story of 9/11, but told in a satirical way that's just ridiculous and actually makes you laugh. And That, for whatever reason, I genuinely thought, well, this is a little inside joke for the 9/11 truth movement. People in 9/11 truth will probably find this funny, but that's it. And then I posted it, and the next day I woke up and it already had several hundred thousand views. It went on to get millions and millions and millions more. For whatever reason, that touched a chord with people. And whenever I tell that story, people always say, well, that's what you should just do parody videos. You should do more of those. Well, no, that's not what I want to do. I want to do all sorts of different things. But beyond that, the type of work that generally resonates with people and that my audience will remember are generally my large documentary projects. I did a documentary on the history of the Federal Reserve. I did a history on how and why big oil conquered the world. And some that I don't consider to be documentaries, but still resonate with people. I did a piece on hopium a few years ago, talking about politics and how it's used to distract people from what they can actually be accomplishing in the real world, et cetera, et cetera. So those types of subjects have really resonated with people, but they're not necessarily all my favorite work. I think I've done a lot of different work. And one thing that I'm quite proud of when I look back on my archive is that I like to think that if you go through the archive, really actually start to go through my episodes, you'll find there's not a lot of filler in there. I really do try to put out an important piece of information. I try to teach people something with basically everything that I do. And I'm not always successful, I'm sure, but hopefully more successful than not. And so, again, it's the interesting thing from my perspective as a media creator is that you truly never, ever know what will or will not resonate with an audience. Because there are times when I put so much effort into something and I know this is great, that's jam-packed with information, and crickets. No one even notices it happened. And then there are times when I put something out, I'm like, I don't know if I said that right. I don't know. Did it come out okay? And people love it. And you just never know how people are going to respond to it.
Yeah, I fully resonate with that. I know that feeling well. You mentioned politics and the massive distraction that it has become. And I think that we cannot have this conversation right now without talking about the US election, which just happened. But bringing it back to the subject of independent media, do you think that there's a chance that the outcome of this recent election will have the possibility of either saving independent media or burying it fully in the ground? Is it that seminal?
It's an interesting question. I would say there is the possibility that it will bury it in the ground, at least if not completely and finally. As I say, I think that's independent spirit will always survive. But in the form that it is today, maybe this is the writing on the wall for the beginning of a censorship regime, the likes of which we haven't yet even begun to dream of. So I think that that is a possibility. But whether it would save independent media, I cannot imagine how any selection process in the political sphere is going to save independent media. I think that's up to the independent media producers themselves and the extent to which they're willing to do this, even in the face of adversity.
Yeah. I think that goes maybe back to your idea of hopium, where I think a lot of people are putting a lot of stock in certain billionaires saving free speech for us, which comes with a lot of very big question marks, in my opinion. But no, I think you're right. I think that independent spirit will always exist. And then it's just a matter of, will it continue in its same form, which, you know, guaranteed there'll be some changes, but will it continue in its same volume? Because I think there are more independent voices now that we're able to access than probably ever before. And that's great. But, you know, those who will survive, again, will have to prove their mettle, I think.
Yes. And I don't know, I guess that could be framed in a negative sense. Oh, you know, it's been diluted. There are too many people these days and what have you. But no, I don't see it that way. I think that this is the natural evolution of the international online dialogue communication that is taking place right now, in which eventually it will become normalized that everybody has their say in the greater societal conversation. The idea of having a podcast or something will not be some unusual idea. It's just everyone will have the ways in which they participate in online discussion, which may be audio, may be visual, may just be textual, whatever it is. But everyone is part of the conversation. Everyone has something to bring to the table. And one would like to think there's a meritocratic filter there that the best will rise to the top. Unfortunately, it's generally the most bombastic or what have you. It becomes a popularity contest at some point. But at the very least, I like to think that that thoughtful and intelligent people who are looking for thoughtful and intelligent commentary online will be able to find it as more and more people come online. And that's a good thing. Because I truly, truly believe that the most important resource on the planet by far is not gold or tungsten or copper or anything like that. No, it is the human brain. The more brains that we put on the table in terms of coming to understanding of various subjects, the more likely we are to find an idea that will resonate, that will have an impact. And so more people in the conversation is to the good. Even if I don't agree with them, I'm certainly not one of these people that wants to be some sort of gatekeeper. You cannot have your say. Don't speak. No, I think that anyone who has that impulse, who wants to stop other people from coming to the table, well, come to your own conclusions about that type of person and their motivations. But personally, I wouldn't trust them.
Yeah. I know you mentioned earlier that you don't want to get into, you know, making lists for people of who you should trust and who you shouldn't trust. But I wanted to ask you as a sort of closing question. You're not really on social media. So what is your daily information diet like? Where do you go? Who do you read? Do you read things just to see the other side? What's your life cycle there and information consumption look like?
Well, I use RSS, actually, because, of course, it's not just for podcasts, although it is for that, too, but it's also for news. So I am subscribed to a number of different RSS feeds of various news sites. And then I go in through my RSS feed reader, and every day I'll have 100 or 200 articles or whatever it is, and I can go through and I can see which headlines I'm interested in, and I'll click through and I'll read those articles. So that is the way that I'm accessing information. And it's funny because I was on Twitter several years ago, and that was one way that I found and sourced news stories and information and kept up with what was happening. And there's a story behind it. People can look up on my site, but eventually I got to the point where it was not a net gain, not a net positive for me. Yeah. And for example, I found myself out at my park playing with my children, getting my little pocket slave device out and looking at my Twitter feed. And what am I doing? What is happening? Why am I doing this? So anyway, I got completely rid of Twitter, got off of it altogether. And yes, as you say, I'm not really on any social media at this point, but I don't need it. And I have zero FOMO. I'm not, you know, afraid of missing out on anything because I am able to essentially choose my sources and choose what I'm going to look at. And then it will be there when I want to look at it. And I don't have to be constantly scrolling through some feed, some algorithmically controlled feed that some third-party middleman has decided you should see this story, you shouldn't see this story. No, I'm going to follow a bunch of different news sources directly, and I will decide what I want to read. And wow, that makes it very easy for me. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. You are definitely my role model now for how I would like to be a consumer of information, because, you know, we have literally just walked ourselves into a new form of slavery, and you just described it perfectly. And the more people who extract themselves, more thinking people who extract themselves from that, the sooner the better, I think. So just in closing, remind people how they can find you and what they will find when they get there.
So I am at CorbettReport.com. That's CORBETT report.com. And when you get there, you will see, essentially 17 years of archives of information, from podcasts and videos to articles and interviews and on all sorts of different subjects. And there is a little it's called New Start Here at the top of the page. So if you are new, you might want to click there and you'll see some categories with some of my most important works there. But basically, just explore it. It's all free, freely available information. Use it as an archive and as a reference. And if it's valuable to you, great. If it's not, you can just move on. I am on a number of different video platforms, Rumble and Odyssey and BitChute and what have you. But essentially, CorbettReport.com is the place to go. And CorbettReport.com/feed is the auto-generated RSS feed for my website. I also have an RSS tab where there are a bunch of different RSS feeds, so you can subscribe to interviews or podcasts or articles or what have you individually.
Amazing. James, thank you so much for coming on Collapse Life. I hope that you will be able to come back at some point and go a little bit more into depth. I would love to talk to you about your work on the Federal Reserve.
Mm. Yep. Anytime.
Well, as always, we are so grateful to have guests like James who are so kind to share their time and their expertise with us each week. We couldn't do any of this without you, our readers and viewers, and we're very thankful to each and every one of you as well. If you're not subscribed to this channel yet, please do hit the subscribe button and share this video with people you know. And we will work very quickly on getting our Collapse Life RSS feed up as well. Collapse Life is a thinking person's guide to civilization and demise, and we're very happy to have you with us. You can follow us on Substack at collapselife.substack.com. We are also on Twitter at collapse_life. And we have a little store with some great designs. So that's at collapselife.com. Check all that out and then head back here next week for another episode of this podcast. We will be sure to have another amazing guest and we look forward to seeing you then. Until then, keep your chin up. It's only collapse. See you soon.